Good morning. We'll call the meeting to order of the Agriculture Policy Committee for this week, this Wednesday morning.
Good morning.
I think we may be towards the end of our overviews, so we'll get to more bills next week. But today we have a couple of overviews. Again, the Department of Ag coming in to talk to us about the pesticide applicator education and training material, and then one that may pique your interest, a report again from the MDA on the just released report on industrial hemp. So those two are on the agenda for this morning. Again, welcome to those in the audience today, and we'll get going. And we do have a quorum, so Representative Backer, would you check the minutes and give us the thumbs up or thumbs down on the minutes?
I would move to approve the minutes.
Thanks, Representative. All in favor of approving the minutes from the meeting of February 4th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Approve, same sign. Minutes approved. Thank you much. First up today, we have the Department of Agriculture, and hear the report from them on the pesticide applicator, the education and training materials that they have and make available to ag people across the state who want to buy and use some of these restricted use chemicals. Good morning, and tell us who you are for the record.
Good morning. My name is Joe Spitzmuller. I'm a manager in the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division of the Department of Agriculture. And thank you for this opportunity.
Go ahead.
I think you have in front of you the applicator training report. Just walking through it briefly, it provides some background on applicator certification in the state, the Department of Agriculture's authority to do that. It talks about the legislative directive from 2 years ago about improving and updating our training materials with the use of dollars from the pesticide regulatory account. It goes on to give you, I'm going through this quickly and we'll go back a little more slowly, but on page four it gives you categories of certification in which we train applicators and ensure their competency and qualifications. And then finally we summarize with some of the progress that we have made since 2013 on these reports. But let me, if I may, Mr. Chair, slow down just a little bit and sort of walk through this a little bit more slowly. The Department of Agriculture issues licenses to applicators who demonstrate competency to apply pesticides properly and safely. People qualify for these licenses by passing examinations that demonstrates their qualifications. I often, frankly, in my desk, I get calls from general public who ask me kind of a simple question, and that is, and they may be concerned for a variety of reasons about, say, an application to a neighbor's property or pesticide applications in their area. They may say, do applicators know what they're doing? Do applicators know how to use pesticides safely and properly? And I can say absolutely yes, that they do. They go through a rigorous training and testing exercise. We have high standards of training, and that's what this is about today. That's what this applicator report is saying, is that the standards for pesticide applicators are high in the state, and we continue to improve. So we talk a lot about exams and manuals, and with your permission, Mr. Chair, I brought some materials that perhaps would help, if I may pass them out.
Certainly our staff will help get those around. Thank you.
Perhaps in this order. Yes. So there are three manuals that I wanted to show you. These are what we refer to when we talk about training manuals. What you'll see there on the top is a core competency manual. And this is a manual that outlines outlines category scope. It And so all applicators are required to understand basic applicator principles. You'll see in that manual, sort of tucked in, is a small card, which is a representation of the license an applicator would get after they have passed the exam based on this manual. That's the card, for those of you who were in the session yesterday, I referred to folks going and making purchases of restricted-use pesticides. An applicator would need to produce that card in order to use restricted-use pesticides. They're required to have those cards on their person whenever they apply pesticides. But applicator manuals that you're seeing there outline category scope. They identify essential knowledge, skills, and ability that are needed by an applicator to perform their duties safely and effectively. To produce manuals such as these, they draw upon subject matter experts who can identify those skills, abilities, and knowledges that are important and essential to perform these tasks. You'll see in the foreword in each of these manuals acknowledgments, and you'll see that we draw from a variety of sources, both public, private regulators, private industry folks, academia, to produce these manuals. So it's a wide range of resources that we draw from to produce the manuals. So we have 21 categories. You'll see that in the applicator report. Some categories are duplicated for various applicators, but we have essentially 21 certification categories that establish minimum competency for applicators. The categories you have in front of you are, one of them is for private pesticide applicators. These are essentially farmers who use material on their own land to produce an agricultural commodity. The other is more geared towards the commercial applicator, a custom applicator, someone who applies pesticide for the purpose of lawn care. Perhaps they apply pesticide for the purpose of controlling mosquitoes, to control right-of-way, for forestry applications. All of these are various types of certification, and we have manuals in all of these various categories. But these manuals serve as a guide for applicators to help them prepare to take the exam. They provide the information we draw on to create the exam, and they also set the baseline for ongoing training that applicators receive in order to renew and maintain their license. Exams are written, I've referred to that a couple of times, exams are written from the manuals. These are tools that we use to determine competency. The exams are written in such a manner that will clearly demonstrate to us that an applicator has the capacity to read and understand a pesticide applicator label, which is the basis for any application. They also show us that an applicator understands appropriate regulation, pesticide use concepts, important to keeping people safe, utilizing proper protections to minimize risks from pesticide applications. So these are what exams are. We validate exams. We draft them and validate them with what we refer to as subject matter experts. So when we write an exam, we bring in folks from industry and say, does this exam make sense to you? Is this a reasonable measure of an applicator's competency? So we do not create any of these documents in a vacuum. They're created in association with industry experts that we rely on and trust in our development. I just this morning, if I may, Mr. Chair, just another. This is a document that may not be. It's a little bit jargony, but it is. It refers to an issue that I'm going to talk about a little bit. So if I could have you take a look at this. When we get together and talk as a group of subject matter experts, the first document we produce is an outline of material. It is not the manual that you see in front of you. It's this outline. And I apologize for the jargon that's involved in that, but that's just the way this document comes out. But I wanted to show you an example of what this document is a result of a discussion between subject matter experts about what are the essential knowledge, skills, and abilities that an applicator must have to perform duties. And in this particular area, this would be in rights of way, forestry, and in a new area that we call natural areas. So you can get a sense of the, I think from that, the issues that are covered, the range of issues, the depth of issues that are covered. This will be our foundation to achieve the manuals that you see in front of you. In 2013, we were told that we had a number of old manuals on the shelf, that we were relying on manuals that were out of date and had been around for a very long time. And that, to an extent, that was true. And the effort that we're talking about is to change, reduce the shelf life of manuals, ensure that this training is up to date and current, and addresses many current issues. But in addition to that, what we've also had to undertake is a reorganization of certain categories. I talked yesterday briefly about structural pest control, and this was an example of how we're trying to reorganize categories, which will allow us to focus training where it's needed. I mentioned yesterday, currently the statute is very expansive and covers both pesticidal activities and non-pesticidal activities. And in an attempt to make sure that the training focuses on pesticide application, that's our attempt to reorganize this category. The draft outline that you see there is another attempt in which we've combined three uses: forestry, rights of way, and an area we call natural areas. This is restoration of areas into native prairies or other types of natural settings. These applicators were never really included in any category before. Our initial discussion on this category was there a synergy between these three groups, and could we organize this category under one umbrella? Initially, there was reluctance to do this. The categories felt that individually they needed more attention, and what we worked towards is a collaborative effort in which these three groups came together and essentially reorganized this category under a single umbrella. That's another example of reorganizing categories.
Mr. Spitzmuller, when you're talking about this new area of natural areas, what comes to my mind would be DNR, WMAs. What kind of land are you talking about when you're talking about natural areas?
These are areas where people are trying to restore probably native vegetation, native prairies, native habitat into an area. These might be some of the areas that you reference, but there's a growing industry in the restoration of these native prairies, natural aquatic areas, those sorts of areas. These are people that work in these areas. They're not exactly forests. They're not exactly rights of way. They're not exactly lawns. There are these areas that require the reintroduction of native habitat into a particular area.
So with the increased emphasis the last couple of years on bees and pollinators, if this pertains to chemical application, would there be an emphasis on practices and chemicals that are more bee-friendly, for example?
Right. So one of the things you'll see in our... Yes, sir. One of the things, Mr. Chair, you'll see in the Turf and Ornamental Manual, and I'm not sure where that is right now, but there's an entirely new chapter dealing with pollinators and pollinator protections, pollinator habitats. So with this progression in manual development, we've been able to incorporate new issues, emerging issues, pollinators and pollinator protections is one, into these manuals and into the applicator training.
Go ahead.
We currently have the majority of our applicators are currently, I'll say, covered, but they are certified really under manuals and exams that are less than 5 years old. You see that our private applicator manual was published in 2011. We do have plans to revise that in the next 2 years. Our commercial applicator for Emmanuel was published in 2014. So we have new and up-to-date material. Our turf and ornamental manual was published last year, 2014. We are working, as I talked about, on our a new aquatic manual that should be published at the end of this year or the beginning of 2016. Our natural area forestry right-of-way combined manual should be published in 2017. We expect a new structural pest control manual to be published in 2017 or 2018. These are some of the changes that are forthcoming. One of the challenges that we face and we continue to face is how to address what we would refer to as minor categories. You'll see in the report some of the categories listing the number of applicators certified in that particular category is perhaps 20 people or perhaps 10 people or some number like that. And how do you maintain a manual of that kind of substance for a category of that size? That was one of the strategies of incorporating the forestry manual with right-of-way, because generally forestry is a fairly small number of people certified in that category in the state. We're also looking to create alternatives to paper. We would like to move away from paper. That's a hard change to make because we've relied on paper so long. But more and more of our manuals are being put online and are available in electronic format. We are in discussion about creating training, more interactive training that would rely on sort of electronic formats. We do expect we will see some of that with the publication of our structural pest control manual. This is a highly specialized group that work in extremely sensitive areas. We're looking at very high quality training there. And we're also developing a new system of delivering exam results. One of the criticisms that we have heard is that it takes so long to get results back. When I take an exam, it takes so long to get back information about did I pass or did I not pass. Obviously, these are really critical results to applicators who need this license to perform work. So we're in the process of implementing new exam result delivery systems that will speed up the process of making sure people are licensed more quickly. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions from the committee members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Spitzmuller, Mayor Spitzmuller, thanks for coming. I've been flying for just about 30 years as a professional, and I'm looking through your manual here. Which one is this called? The Private Pesticide Applicator Manual. In your table of contents, as well as one of your chapters, it says that aerial applicants of pesticides are regulated by the FFA. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
So I don't know if that needs to be corrected in here, because I know the FAA has been regulating me for 30 years. I'd love to take a check ride with the FFA, but just wanted to point that out to you that this should be probably corrected.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Hamilton.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, that's accurate. Yeah. I'm just teasing. You know, I was reading through that, and what I like about it, you hear a lot of opposition to pesticides and others, but it's interesting. In one of the books that I was reading through quickly, it talked about the pest problems throughout history. The Black Plague in Europe in the 14th century, the Ireland potato crop was completely wiped out in the 19th century. And this is a way that we can control exotic invasive plants and insects that harm our native plants. And so there's definitely a need there and some positive benefits. I really liked and appreciated your opening comments when you talked about the extensive training and that it is safe when it comes to application and whatnot. Thank you for all that you do. I greatly appreciate that. I know there's not a question in there. You know what, I do have a question, Mr. Spitzmuller. Do you also regulate and enforce internet sales? Is there an issue there at all? Is anything that needs to be addressed?
Mr. Spitzmuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Hamilton. In fact, we do. We regulate the sale of restricted use pesticides over the internet. We require that all restricted use pesticides sold, and frankly, all pesticides that include a worker protection standard labeling on their label, all of those require licensure. So the dealer selling, whether from a brick and mortar store or by the internet, is regulated and needs to be licensed by the Department of Agriculture and report their sales to us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bly is next.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. And I'm one of those folks that is concerned about chemicals and pesticide. And, you know, I'm sorry I missed your historical information. I also know that historically, sometimes when we interfere with nature, we create more problems. And, you know, the potatoes themselves were not native to Ireland, and I also know of a story where not so long ago in China, Mao heard that sparrows were bad for the environment, and he went had people go around and at one day kill almost all the sparrows in China, and the following years they had problems with locusts and other insects because they destroyed a natural pesticide control. And I guess what my question is. This isn't necessarily your charge, but I'm wondering if the department is looking at ways to look to nature to help to control things. I mean, sometimes it's man that throws the balance of nature out of sync, and we cause the problems that we may want to avoid later. And I guess I'm just wondering, is there any research or any consideration of non-chemical kinds of controls of pests?
Mr. Spitzmuller.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. If you look into each of the manuals, you'll see a chapter or an area devoted to the concept of integrated pest management. Integrated pest management is a tool used by applicators and promoted in applicator training that incorporates a variety of management and control techniques. So. As opposed to simply saying, I worked for a number of years as a researcher at the U, and we used a phrase called spray and pray, and so we relied heavily on chemicals during that time. But applicators are trained today to rely on a variety of techniques that go beyond the use of pesticide to affect the control that we're talking about. And that's usually highlighted in the area that we call integrated pest management in these manuals. But absolutely, applicators are often told that it isn't, your only option isn't simply to apply pesticides.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that comment. It's encouraging.
Thank you.
Point well taken. I would just give an example. In soybeans, we face a problem every year with aphids, and if there are enough Asian lady beetles around in those fields, it's a natural predator of the aphid, and if the levels of aphids don't get too high, then the Asian beetles can take care of it, as you say, with the best management practice without chemical application. But again, if those levels get too high that the beetles can't handle it, then we have to go in there and spray. But we look, first of all, to have a natural source take care of that, in this case, the beetle. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Spitzmuller, I'm curious about the exams. My students at Minnesota State take exams before they become teachers, so that's That's always an interesting topic for me. I'm wondering, picking up on the question about pollinators, I would assume that in the, and I'm thinking back to the Hendricks family that was before the Ag Finance Committee last week, they talked about drift of pesticides affecting bees and affecting their bees. Are the test questions related to pollination, risk to pollinators and drift and that sort of thing?
Right. Mr. Spitzmuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yes, what we try to do is when we create an exam, and perhaps we can learn from you, but what we try to do is create a broad item bank of questions. So we work our way through the material that's presented in the manual, and when we create a broad, what we call an item bank, for some manuals that might be up to 300 questions. And then we draw from that item bank to create a question that might be 50, it might be 75 or 100 questions in length. So we offer that exam, but also we have the opportunity to rotate that exam with questions similar in similar areas of questioning, but different, if you will, so that applicators aren't necessarily seeing the same exam over and over, but they will see an exam that represents the manual, the material they studied from, the material that has been developed and deemed to be that essential material. They will see that. They will see representative questions from that manual. So the direct answer to your question is yes, they will see pollinator questions. They might not see the same question over and over, but they will see pollinator questions.
As I said, applicators must go through recertification training to maintain their license. So they don't necessarily take the exam over and over again, but they'll go to training repeatedly, sometimes every year, sometimes every 2 years, depending on category. And it was very interesting this fall to be at a number of trainings which involved turf applicators, and to say to them that maybe you want to have a conversation, or it would be useful for you to have a conversation with your customer and say, do you understand that the white clover you want me to control here is a really high-quality forage material for the pollinators. Perhaps you want to leave a patch of clover in your yard as material that pollinators could forage on. And that was a really an eye-opening discussion for some applicators, because lots of people don't like clover in their lawns. So,
Representative Johnson, follow up.
Thank you. And then the exams, are they given online or is it a paper exam?
Mr. Spitzmuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Actually, both. We have paper exams because, again, many people are very familiar with paper exams. For some folks, online exams are intimidating, and I really shouldn't use the term online. They're computer-based exams. So people, the exams are not given online. They're given on a computer or they're given paper. The new exam delivery system, we are hoping to incorporate a more online aspect to it. We're developing security around that because we want to maintain the integrity of the exams. But again, that in order to deliver the exam results more quickly, we need to move towards a more online system. And so we are working to develop that system now.
Representative Johnson.
And then another question, where do they take the exams?
Mr. Spitzmuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. We have a test center at the Department of Agriculture. It is located right inside the front door. There are 16 corrals there, which means essentially 16 stations that folks can come in and test. We test twice. We have two sessions daily, so we can take up to 32 folks a day at that test center. Generally, people take about, if they take two exams, it's usually about a two-hour session. in bigger, we alternatively, we work with industry groups such as Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. They will offer sessions in which they walk through the study manuals with applicators. So the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association wants to provide their membership even more training and more chances of success at the exam. So they will walk their members through the study manuals in preparation for an exam. And we can work with organizations like MNLA and deliver that same exam by paper on site. And so we'll be working, I think, in two sessions in March and April at the Ties Building at used to be the old International Harvester Building, I believe, on Snelling and Larpender. And there'll be an exam session there, probably 125 to 150 people at those sessions. So most folks take the exams in the department. We do work with some county ag inspectors who administer the exams locally, and we do special sessions with organizations like MNLA.
Follow up again, Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. The pass rates. Do you know, can you share with us the pass rate on the exams?
Mr. Spitzmuller.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. It's a good question. Our average score for the core material, the core exam, that's the exam on, there's a green book floating around. The average score of that exam is 74%. So that's the average score of the first exam. People can take an exam up to three times. So the second attempt and the third attempt, the score improves. So on first attempt, passing is probably about approximately 70% of the people pass. But those folks will get an opportunity to test again and again. The passing rate for the TURF exam, which is also going around, is about 76%. So again, we look to these kinds of statistics to ensure that our exams are sort of positioned correctly. We want similar cut scores between exams, so we'll look at exam statistics to try to get that effect.
More questions? Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I'm just wondering, with the manuals and the tests, are there more people being certified to do this kind of work? Is this creating a greater wealth of people who can be certified? And
Mr. Spitzmuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Our number of folks licensed to apply pesticides has stayed fairly stable for commercial applicators. The number of folks, private applicators, farmers, has stabilized but dropped substantially. When I first came to work at the department some years ago, I think there were somewhere in the range of 50,000 private applicators certified to apply restricted-use pesticides. Now, 20 years later, I think we are at 17,000. So that number has dropped dramatically, whereas the number of commercial applicators has pretty much stayed flat at around 11,000 applicators.
Representative Bly.
And how does the manuals and the exams that we give and all that, how does that compare with other states? Do they have a similar regime or a way of making sure that people are up to date with the pesticides?
Mr. Spitzmuller.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yeah, the answer is yes. It's a similar strategy. We operate under delegated authority from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. They examine our certification system and approve it just as they do in other states. So we all operate under similar delegated authority and similar approval. So in fact, we often share share the work of developing manuals, and sometimes we even share the work of writing exams if our particular situations are similar enough. Yes, our well, I'd like to think ours is better and perhaps the best. Our systems are very similar to other states.
Any more questions? I had a question, Mr. Spitzmuller, concerning the private pesticide applicator license. Without that card, does this license allow a person to apply or purchase or both?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It allows them to do both. It allows them to purchase and apply. We recognize there are some situations in which, at certain times of the year, producers are so busy, they at times will have to send a spouse or a fam or an associate to pick up particular products. But as long as they can demonstrate the car, they demonstrate that the applicator is certified, the dealer can release the product to a person who's picking it up on their behalf. But the answer to your question is they have to have the card to do both.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I mentioned this a couple years ago. My 3-year license expires March 1st, so I'll be coming over to take that test here one of these next couple weeks. And I have taken it online or on the computer also, and as I recall, passed it the first time, and the results are pretty much right away when you take it online, correct?
That's correct. The system is for private applicators is slightly different than commercial applicators, but those are made available instantaneously, and congratulations.
I had to really study for it. Any questions, follow-up comments? Thank you, Mr. Spitzmuller.
Thank you very
good
much.
Good program. I think the manuals and such speak to themselves. They are comprehensive and do a good job of teaching those that make use of them. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Next up, we have the Department of Agriculture to enlighten us on their report on industrial hemp. Welcome this morning. Identify yourselves for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Anthony Cordelet, and I'm a weed scientist. Before you laugh, I'll explain what that means. It's not to deal with cannabis. I oversee the noxious weed program for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And what I want to do today is give you a brief overview. I'm assuming everyone has a copy of the research report we just completed. I'll give a brief overview, and then I'll open it up to questions for you folks based on some of the findings that we gathered. Essentially, we were given the directive to gauge the interest of other states nationally in terms of implementing the new provisions that were given or were made to the most recent farm bill. And a second obligation we had to meet was to also gauge the interest of institutions of higher education in the state as to whether they would want to participate in some type of a research program for industrial hemp, which the Farm Bill provisions allowed for. And so with that, we struggled for a little bit to think about how would be the best way to do this. Obviously, with cannabis laws in the United States right now, they vary from state to state, and they vary depending on whether they deal with what's commonly referred to as marijuana or what's commonly referred to as industrial hemp. And it gets even murkier because federal law does not differentiate between the two. It's all just marijuana. So we decided to try to do a quick and simple survey to gauge the interest of both of those entities. per the directive by the legislature.
Just a second, Mr. Cordelette. Could you back up a second and explain briefly the provisions in that farm bill which led to the study?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Essentially, the farm bill has, for the first time since cannabis has been regulated, provided provisions that if a state would approve an industrial hemp pilot program, that either institutions of higher education within that state or the Department of Agriculture can go ahead and produce a crop and also develop a research pilot program for that to, you know, it's pretty vague on what you can do research-wise, but essentially alluding to, you know, the production values and also the economics of industrial hemp.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Absolutely. The first survey that we conducted was of the U.S. states, and we used the National Plant Board as a vehicle to get out to each of the states the survey that we wanted them to look at. And the reason for that is every state has a state plant regulatory official that we could reach out to. And if they weren't the best person to answer the questions in the survey, we asked that they forward it on to whoever in their state system would be. In that survey, we got 34 responses. And the survey was essentially made up of 8 questions. 34 responses isn't bad return if you understand the activity nationally for industrial hemp right now. There's about 19 states that have some type of activity going on, either an actual act within their state legislature that provides for production of industrial hemp, or they're trying to develop some type of a research program, as the provisions in the Farm Bill have recently allowed for. Overall, in that survey, the 19 states, as I said, have something that is in place right now. Out of the 34 that responded, that's a little more than half. Generally, in the results that are provided in the summary of this survey from the states to those questions that we provided them, the overall feeling is certainly more than half, around 60% or more, are either pursuing some type of legislation within their state to allow for industrial hemp production, or they feel that kind of the trends that are happening with cannabis across the U.S. right now, within the next decade, they will probably see something happening within their state. The second survey that we conducted was of institutions of higher education in the state of Minnesota. To do that was a little more difficult. How do you reach out to all of those folks? What we tried to do was use the 3 main conduits of communication there. One, the University of Minnesota system, as well as MinSCU and the private colleges. And so we were able to get representatives from all 3 of those entities to provide our survey out to researchers throughout the state. That survey was a little different than the one that we sent out to the states because it was gauging more interest in actual research around industrial hemp versus just any general activity at the state level. We only got 13 responses. To be honest with you, I can't tell you whether that's good or bad. I don't know how many researchers there are in the state. We didn't collect that kind of information versus how many replied. Of the 13, 12 were from the University of Minnesota, and 1 was from the MinSCU system. And it appeared in general from the responses to the questions, certainly our first question was asking them, were they aware of the provisions in the Farm Bill, and less than 50% were. So the information, at least in the academic world here in Minnesota, doesn't appear to be getting out as much as you would have thought. Either that or the interest on the research side of things might be lower. However, I would say over 50% in the rest of our questionnaire in the survey were favorable to doing some type of research with industrial hemp, in also suggesting that it would be a smart option for the legislature to continue pursuing some type of pilot program as it pertains to the farm bill. So with that, that's a brief summary. I also want to mention that we did back this up by cross-referencing with the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture, which also have a summary that's included in the back of the report. And it's basically they had formed an industrial hemp working group where they did a similar thing, only in a more strategic format, where members of their working group filled in for each one of their states what type of activity they were involved with. And then we also looked at the National Conference of State Legislatures website to cross-reference their data that they have for hemp activity. And looking at them based on the data we got from our survey, there's a few little differences depending on a couple states and how they reported, but overall they're fairly accurate with each other. So that was somewhat promising when we were able to see that. And with that, I'd open it up to any questions you folks may have.
Questions to the testifier on the industrial hemp research? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if you're growing industrial hemp, and in the same field, if you would plant just a portion of that as commonly referred to as marijuana, would it cross-pollinate and lower the THC to the marijuana? Is that something that would actually take place?
Mr. Cordelet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, that's an excellent question. Cannabis has a male and female plant, and one of the things that you don't want if you're growing marijuana is the first of all, you don't want male plants, and secondly, you don't want it to cross-pollinate with the wild type, which hemp would be related to ditchweed or low THC varieties. So the issue of growing the two of them together is, it is something that if you're illegally trying to grow marijuana, you wouldn't want it to be in an industrial hemp field by any means, because it would cross-pollinate, ruining those genetics. So.
Representative Hamilton.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, that's where I was going with that. If we would legalize industrial hemp, then if there's a illegal market out there, which there is obviously, but marijuana, if it was being illegally grown, the more fields that we would have with industrial hemp would then put that marijuana plant in jeopardy, per se, would it not?
Mr. Cordelet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton. Yeah, that's a good potential for that. You've seen with, even if you look at the recent medical cannabis law in Minnesota, it's all being done indoors for multiple reasons, but also to control those plants so they aren't cross-pollinating. Furthermore, there is two different uses for the plant. Some folks are going to grow industrial hemp for the fiber production, and some will be done for seed production. The only case where you would have an issue of the two plants growing together and really looking similar is when they bud and flower out, and that would be for seed production. So that's another thing to take into consideration. If industrial hemp is being harvested for the fiber, it would most likely be harvested before any of those reproductive organs are developed on the plants.
Representative Franzen.
Hi there. And to the testifiers, thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, could you clarify the definition of hemp under the Federal Farm Bill?
Mr. Cordelet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, essentially under the Federal Farm Bill, industrial hemp is any cannabis plant that contains less than 0.03% THC. And THC is the acronym for, I'm not going to pronounce the actual name for you, but it's the acronym for the cannabinoid that is typically ingested or inhaled to give you the psychoactive effects in marijuana.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, I went to a garden club, I think it was last week, where they were on, they had brought in a gentleman to speak about industrial hemp and the difference between hemp and cannabis. And where hemp is cultivated and grown for that 0.3% or lower, marijuana cannabis these days is up to 20% THC, which is just shocking from when it was in the 60s. They showed the evolution of breeding that marijuana plant to get the higher THC, but the hemp plant, that you can breed it down as low as 0.3% and lower, so pretty exciting stuff. 0.03%, yes.
Okay. Mr. Cordelet, from the farming end of it here, is this crop one that's grown in rows? Is it biennial? Does it come back year after year? Or how would it be handled if it were grown commercially?
Mr. Chair, it's cannabis is an annual plant, high seed producer. So it would be grown year after year. A few years ago we did another industrial hemp report for the legislature, which looked at how other countries were dealing with the legal aspects. And I had a chance to get on the phone with folks in Canada, which is the only other legal country within North America right now that has legalized cannabis and has an industrial hemp program. And it would be similar to other production agricultural systems. I'm not well versed on the planting of it. I've never seen it. But from what I've seen of where it's been done, and now Kentucky and Colorado have actually put some test plots in and harvested them, it's grown in rows, and it would be harvested and then have to be planted the following year.
Okay, thank you. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is, you said it's planted in rows. How is it harvested, and would it represent a fairly large investment for a farmer to get into this if he were to decide to grow it? You know what it would take?
Mr. Cordelet.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not really sure what the investment would be. I do know that it's generally cut with a sickle cutter if it's cut for fiber, and even if I believe they're doing that for seed production too, they leave it in the field for a few days or a week to dry, and then they bale it. I'm not really sure if you were, if you're referring more to a traditional agricultural system like corn and soybeans, what the, adaption to your machinery and things like that would be. I don't know what type of investment would be there. Generally, what I do know about those systems, there would have to be some modifications, and you would have to put some type of an investment in. But what that is, I'm not really sure of.
If it's Mr. Chair, if it's
Representative Franz for Nornes.
That's fine. If it's as simple as baling it, they probably have some of that equipment that could be easily adapted for it. But I was thinking of hand labor, where you go out and shock them like they used to do and pile them up and load them on a wagon.
You're dating yourself now, Representative.
Took all the fun out of farming.
Mr. Chair, I would just add to that, the hand labor in the hemp industry, I think they've gone beyond that. I haven't seen even in Canada gigantic, acreages of industrial hemp. It tends to be put onto marginal farming lands where, other things typically, if you're going to plant, let's say, a traditional crop like corn or soybeans or wheat, you're going to need to put a lot of inputs into the soil and so forth to get that crop to generate an industrial hemp. But it offers that opportunity to put something there with low inputs that's fairly easy to grow in those environments. So,
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, I hope maybe you can shed some light on my confusion about marijuana and hemp as far as the opposition to it and why. I mean, it's part of, it's indigenous, it's something that the country, America used to grow, used to be prior to World War II, and and much of the war products were made out of hemp. But then there became a public safety issue. So, but now we have the Department of Justice has the Cole memo that so that we can, so that the DA policy on enforcement of marijuana, growing marijuana, is changed so that you have, what is it, like 8 different public safety factors, considerations, and as long as state law is consistent with those factors, it incorporates those into state law, then the DA is not going to take enforcement action against growing marijuana. But yet the policy is still for hemp that the DA is going to treat it as though it will take enforcement from it against it. So if anybody tries to grow hemp, they're subject to DA, you know, criminal prosecution. So that inconsistency. So what is the opposition? Is it so we can now have the guidance and ability to address public safety concerns through the Cole memo? We could apply those easily to hemp. So what is the, is it the lack of research, the law's ability to get seeds, or what is it that is slowing this down?
Mr. Cordelet.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you got a couple hours. It's, you know, yeah, there is a memo, but there's also a Controlled Substances Act, and the DEA, I mean, I can't speak on behalf of them. I know they've been invited into legislatures to talk, and they've refused in many cases. And I think the basic answer to your question is the fact that it's still not differentiated in the Controlled Substances Act as marijuana and industrial hemp. As a matter of fact, it's even spelled wrong in the Controlled Substances Act if you read it. But the issue here is that it's kind of all over the board across the U.S. And the states we talked to in this report, kind of some of the things you were alluding at, have kind of directed states whether or not to even pursue passing an industrial hemp act of any kind. The reason for that is the feeling is they're not going to be able to get a permit from the DEA to bring seeds in. Right now, the only legal way to bring seed into the country would be through, let's say, Canada or the Netherlands or China, where it's legal, and the DEA has to approve that. And to give you an example, Kentucky went ahead this year once the Farm Bill provisions were put into place and they knew about it. University of Kentucky had seed shipped in, I believe, from Canada. They got to Lexington, and they were held by the DEA. And it took the governor of Kentucky to threaten suit before those seeds were released and planted. A similar thing happened in Colorado, where they also grew a crop this year. However, the DEA there said if the Commissioner of Agriculture would request that the seeds be approved, they'd approve the permit. So it's kind of, why is one state holding onto the seed until they get sued, and the other one saying, well, as long as you come forward? A lot of this is all happening at once, and there's so much going on right now currently at the federal legislature with Senate Majority Leader McConnell and Rand Paul, which are trying to now get the definition of marijuana in the Controlled Substances Act identified to marijuana as either being high THC, as Representative Franzen was pointing out, or hemp, also included in the Controlled Substances Act. So I don't really have a good answer. All I can tell you is it's kind of a murky area right now, and I think that the DEA, with the medical and the consumption side of marijuana, has sort of turned their head the other way in states where they have laws on the books. I think with industrial hemp, the fear is, whoa, now you're putting it outside in big field production situations, and that's going to potentially bring in a criminal element. So I think there's more fear to that than there is to the smaller type of cannabis operations for consumption and recreation.
Follow up? Good question, Representative. Only took him 5 minutes to answer it. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Corlett, I really like this picture that you've got in the front of this this packet here. Okay, so I'm driving down one of my county roads in my district, and I look over and I see this field that looks just like this. Outside of seeing a sign that says that this would be industrial hemp, is there any way that any layman could just identify, just by looking at the plant, if it is industrial, or the other that some people have claimed that they've never inhaled?
Mr. Cordelet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the short answer is no. The cannabis plant is the cannabis plant. I mean, it's the same genus and species. You're just talking about two different concentrations of a single cannabinoid. So it would be hard to differentiate between the two. However, once they got to the later growth stage, you would be able to tell if somebody was cultivating it for consumptive or recreational use, because they're only first of all, there would be no male plants around there. You can tell the difference between the male and female flowers. I work a lot with the noxious weed laws, so the general county ag inspector we work with is not going to be able to tell the difference even at that point. There is a researcher at the University of Minnesota, Dr. George Weiblin, who I know is trying to do some, he has a DEA permit in right now that's being reviewed by the DEA, and back to your point, I think they've been reviewing that for about a year now or more, to do research that could potentially look at changing the color of the plant. So some genetic modifications, although my understanding of that is there's some refusal to do that by the hemp community because it has genetic modification to it too. So there's some problems in that also. But with that said, if you could develop a plant that was distinguishable in some way, then you know we'd at least have a little better situation for law enforcement to be able to recognize it. But yeah, right now there's just not a real good way for me to say you'd be able to tell the difference between the two.
Good discussion. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to remember, Representative Anderson, that hemp is actually grown for height as well. And so hemp stalks are going to be about 15 feet high before they get harvested, and so definitely can tell a difference. And also, if somebody were driving by a hemp field and thought, well, I just really would like to try this out and smoke it, they're going to learn a lesson real quick, because all they're going to get is very sick, including a major headache.
I'll take your word for that. Interesting. And as you were talking about a different color for the hemp plant, I thought that could be another avenue for GMOs to get involved in this. But Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cordelet, thank you for your study. I'm curious about just the market for it. And is there a global market? Is this grown elsewhere? Is it how big of an industry is it? Can you give us some picture on that?
Mr. Cordelet.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there is a global market. Currently, all of the hemp that resides in the United States as a finished product comes from either China, most likely Canada. Those are probably the two main sources, and some maybe from the Netherlands and other places where it's legal. You know, your question about in terms of would there be a market in the United States? There's been a lot of studies done on that. Most recently, the University of Kentucky conducted an economic study. And these studies, although they're very complex, they're very hard to generate, I think, the concrete information you want, because it's a non-existing commodity yet here in the U.S. And apparently not a lot exists from prior to World War II, when it was still being produced here in the U.S., on what type of economics were involved with that. The one thing I'll use to answer your question is that in Kentucky, as most of you know, a big tobacco growing state, and they've been hit very hard. That's a major, you know, agricultural commodity for producers in Kentucky, and they've been hit very hard over the last two decades just in the changes to the tobacco industry. they're hoping that something like industrial hemp can fill the void in those tobacco fields, which generally would not be good places for corn and soybean agriculture. And, you know, so from a state like Kentucky, who also before prohibition of cannabis was a leader in the United States in hemp production too. In terms of Minnesota, my guess would be there would be some interested folks. I know there already are a few, but in terms of replacing large acres of corn and soybeans, probably not. But there are marginal lands. If you look at, you know, I'm thinking of places like maybe Mille Lacs or Aiken County or far northwest Minnesota. You know, that's an opportunity for diversification. To either pasture lands or some row crop agriculture. What that's going to amount to is anybody's guess. And so going back to the Kentucky study, that's one study, but then there's others that say, well, it's not going to promote very much in terms of economics. But they're also comparing it to, you know, almost 200 million acres of corn, soybeans, and wheat in the U.S. So probably not going to be that big, but it does have an opportunity.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you. Is there any potential for biofuels?
Yes.
Mr. Cordelet.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there would be. And as a matter of fact, the major production with cannabis right now in terms of industrial hemp is through seed oil. It's probably the most profitable. You probably hear most of the conversation centered around fiber and clothing and things of that, and which is also important. But it's very easy to use existing seed production facilities to convert the seed to the oil. It could be used for biofuels. I don't know if any studies have been done on that yet or not. I know that I had a chance to sit in on a biofuels explanation of Central Lakes College up in, around Staples that are doing some work with canola and some other things, and I had asked that question, and, you know, they didn't know, but it was something they'd, you know, be interested possibly in researching. So I do know the oil right now produce plastics out of it and various products like that, so... Like a lot of other vegetables, it would produce a viable biofuel.
Representative Johnson.
My last question is, you mentioned there's low inputs. How low are the inputs? Is it a very simple crop to grow, or does it require some treatment and that sort of thing?
Mr. Cordelet.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as a weed scientist, I always find it interesting when I hear somebody talk about growing a weed, which cannabis used to be thought of not in the sense of weed smoke, but just noxious weed. And it was a noxious weed here at one time. You know, the inputs, apparently the people that are cultivating, whenever you're trying to put anything into a row crop situation, they talk about weed problems in their cannabis. So I don't really know. And when I talked to the folks in Canada a couple years ago, the inputs were extremely low. Some folks were, you know, very organic, if you will, about no, you know, pesticide or even fertilizer inputs. So that generally seems to be the theme when you talk to folks, and even the research, I think, out of Kentucky, they talked about some weed pressure competing with their cannabis plants, but they didn't talk about treating it. So my assumption there was they planted it, the crop, and with no nitrogen, as an example, added to the soil or no pesticides at all. So the inputs are known to be very low.
One more follow-up, Representative.
Okay, thank you. Then that naturally leads me to the question about potential for cover crops after harvest. Is it harvested relatively early? When's it typically harvested, or is it also friendly to a potential for a cover crop?
Mr. Cordelet.
Mr. Chair, Representative, most likely it would not. It's just it's such a hardy plant, and it takes a long time for it to I don't want to say it takes a long time for it to develop, but you know, when versus something like your traditional cover crops, maybe a winter annual mix or something like clover or whatever on a, let's say, a corn soybean field, it's probably not going to fit in very well there. I think Ms. Representative Franzen said it grows very tall, very stout stem to it. So I don't think it would fit in that mold very well, but I could be wrong.
One more, Ms. Representative.
Well, just to clarify, would it be open? I'm thinking of a cover crop applied after harvest, a different crop. Not hemp as the cover crop, but any other. That's what I was thinking.
Mr. Cordelet.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, if I understand what you're saying, it's the cover crop after the planting. Yes, absolutely. Especially if it's harvested for fiber, it would be harvested fairly early compared to a traditional crop, so that would give you growing time in the fall to get something established.
Good line of questioning. I just had a quick follow-up on that. If this became a widely cultivated crop, or at least more than it is now, I think back to a weed, prosomillet, which became a noxious weed, wild prosomillet. Would this hemp, if it were cultivated more widely, have that propensity to become a weed that would spread? Is it easily spread by the wind and become a weed that would not be so friendly?
Mr. Chair, the beans that cannabis is an annual and it's a high seed producer, that's always a chance. You know, obviously, after post-World War II, when it started to get regulated, and it was planted commonly in Minnesota, more so for fiber, it spread very rapidly. And a matter of fact, the reason it was put on the noxious weed list was it would shut down a corn harvester. The stalks would get so thick. The only way I could really answer that from existing information that I know, we took cannabis off the noxious weed list a few years ago simply because the fact that we just were not, our county partners that enforced the law were not getting a lot of complaints about it. It was more the law enforcement side of it where they might see a patch of it or whatever, and those are two separate issues. We're not going after people for smoking it and using it illegally. We were going after them for it being a noxious weed and the spread to it. But it is a high seed producer. It can always spread, and it can do very well in poor habitats.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hamilton.
My question has been answered.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment on those marginal lands up above North Mille Lacs Lake, Aiken County and such. We've got some excellent soil up there, and we actually can grow corn and beans up there, although we've sort of lost the research battle because there's not a lot of work on 75, 80-day corn anymore. So that really hurt us. It does prompt a question, though. Sure. How sensitive is this industrial hemp to frost? Because we watch folks plant while we still got frost in the ground where I live, and same in the fall. Frost comes real early sometimes. So is it sensitive to that,
Mr. Cordelet?
Mr. Chair, Representative, first of all, I love Mille Lacs County. Don't get me wrong. I wasn't trying to take a dig on that. Yes, it is fairly frost hardy. And the fact that it's grown in regions of Manitoba, China, even in you know, colder regions of China and the Netherlands, it does very well in that environment.
Hey, good points. Vice Chair Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've covered quite a bit of what hemp does, but we haven't exactly touched on the food production that the seeds can bring as well. We have hemp oil. Can use instead of using canola or vegetable oil, or I like to use coconut oil in my cooking, hemp oil. A dairy-free alternative to milk would be hemp milk, hemp granola, hemp protein powder, seed butter, hemp nuts, and the seeds itself provide an excellent source of omega-3s and 6s, which a lot of us here aren't exactly getting our daily dose of, and the hemp seeds put into smoothies, cereal, brownies, etc., provide a really good source of this. So hemp itself is well-rounded. The entire stock gets used, making it a very renewable source. And the hemp paper, we want to talk a little bit about paper. can be recycled many more times over than your traditional wood paper, and also uses quite a bit less toxic chemicals. So very good for our environment, and I think if we're going to, you know, move on some on this issue, I think the time is now, Chair Anderson, and I think that you're just as excited as I am.
Yep. You read my thoughts exactly, Representative.
Let's not get more excited.
You didn't say beer.
This has been very good discussion. Any other questions or comments? Anybody in the audience who would care to testify or add their knowledge? If not, we have no more questions from committee members. And thank you, Mr. Cordelette, for your knowledge. And very interesting. Thank you very much. With that, we have no other business. We approve the minutes, correct? Yes. With that, our meeting is adjourned.